I'm on chapter 4, The World as Percept. Concepts and ideas arise through thinking. Words cannot say what a concept is. Words can only make us notice that we have concepts. When we see a tree, our thinking reacts to our observation. A conceptual counterpart joins the object, and we consider the object and the conceptual counterpart as belonging together. When the object disappears from our field of observation, only the conceptual counterpart remains. The latter is the concept of the object. The wider our experience extends, the greater the sum of our concepts. But the concepts by no means stand apart from one another. They combine into a lawful whole. For example, the concept organism combines with others, such as lawful development and growth. Other concepts formed from individual things collapse wholly into a unity. Thus, all concepts that I form about lions combine into the general concept lion. In this way, individual concepts link together into a closed conceptual system in which each has its particular place. Ideas are not qualitatively different from concepts. They are only concepts with more content, more saturated, and more inclusive. I emphasize here that it is important to note at this point that my point of departure is thinking, not concepts or ideas, which must first be gained by thinking. Concepts and ideas already presuppose thinking. Therefore, what I have said about the nature of thinking, that it rests within itself and is determined by nothing, cannot simply be transferred to concepts. Parenthesis, I note this explicitly here, because this is where I differ from Hegel, who posits the concept as first and original. Parenthesis. Concepts cannot be won by observation. This can already be seen from the fact that children form concepts for the objects in their environment only slowly and gradually. Concepts are added onto observation. A popular contemporary philosopher, Herbert Spencer, portrays the spiritual process that we perform in response to observation as follows. If wandering through the fields on a September's day, we hear a noise a few steps in front of us and see the grass in motion by the side of the ditch whence the noise seemed to proceed, then we will probably approach the place to find out what produced the noise and movement. At our approach, there flutters in the ditch a partridge, and with this our curiosity is satisfied. We have what we call an explanation of the phenomena. Carefully examined, this explanation depends on the following. Because in life we have countless times experienced that a disturbance in the peaceful state of small bodies accompanies the movement of other bodies located among them, and because we have therefore generalized the relationships between such disturbances and such movements, we consider this particular disturbance explained as soon as we find that it represents an example of just this relationship. End quote. Examined more closely, however, the situation looks quite different than this description suggests. When I hear a noise, I first seek the concept that fits this observation. Someone who thinks no more of it simply hears the noise and leaves it at that. But by thinking about it, it becomes clear to me that I must regard the noise as an effect. Only when I combine the concept of effect with the perception of the noise am I inclined to go beyond the individual observation itself and seek a cause. The concept of effect evokes that of cause, and I then seek the causative object, which I find in the form of a partridge. But I can never gain the concepts of cause and effect by mere observation, no matter how many cases I may observe. Observation calls forth thinking, and it is only the latter that shows me how to link one isolated experience with another. When people demand of a, quote, strictly objective science, unquote, that it draw its content from observation alone, then they must at the same time demand that it renounce all thinking. For thinking by its very nature goes over and above what has been observed. This is the moment to move from thinking to the being who thinks. For it is through the thinker that thinking is linked to observation. Human consciousness is the stage where concept and observation meet and are connected to one another. This is, in fact, what characterizes human consciousness. It is the mediator between thinking and observation. To the extent that human beings observe things, things appear as given. To the extent that human beings think, they experience themselves as active. They regard things as objects and themselves as thinking subjects. Because they direct their thinking to what they observe, they are conscious of objects. Because they direct their thinking to themselves, they are conscious of themselves. They have self-consciousness. Human consciousness must necessarily at the same time also be self-consciousness, because it is a thinking consciousness. For when thinking directs its gaze toward its own activity, it has before it as its object its very own being, that is, its subject. But we must not overlook that it is only with the help of thinking that we can define ourselves as subjects and contrast ourselves to objects. Therefore, thinking must never be regarded as a merely subjective activity. Thinking is beyond subject and object. It forms both of these concepts just as it does all others. Thus, when we as thinking subjects relate a concept to an object, we must not regard this relationship as something merely subjective. It is not the subject that introduces the relationship, but thinking. The subject does not think because it is a subject. Rather, it appears to itself as a subject because it can think. The activity that human beings exercise as thinking beings is therefore not merely subjective, but it is a kind of activity that is neither subjective nor objective. It goes beyond both these concepts. I should never say that my individual subject thinks. Rather, it lives by the grace of thinking. Thus, thinking is an element that leads me beyond myself and unites me with objects, but it separates me from them at the same time by setting me over against them as subject. Just this establishes the dual nature of the human being. We think, and our thinking embraces ourselves along with the rest of the world. But at the same time, we must also, by means of thinking, define ourselves as individuals standing over against things.